Welcome back to Essentia Foundation's course on analytic idealism. Today we are going to cover part three. Last time in part two, we've reviewed our mainstream metaphysics, namely mainstream physicalism, the idea that all that exists is inert matter, which is not conscious, neither is it in consciousness. It's something totally outside and independent of consciousness, and mind experience somehow arises from that. We've seen that that hypothesis violates coherence, internal logical consistency. It is empirically not adequate. It's certainly not explanatorily powerful, since it creates more problems than it explains. Arguably, it doesn't really explain anything. And finally, it is not conceptually parsimonious, because it makes a postulate about an abstract theoretical entity to which we can never have direct access, namely matter outside and independent of consciousness, since we are cooped up in consciousness, in mentation, which is nature's sole given. Qualitative experience is nature's sole given. Everything else is a theoretical abstraction. And in part two, we've reviewed why that theoretical abstraction isn't helpful at all. On the contrary, it can be reduced to absurdity. So if you haven't seen parts one and two of this course yet, I recommend you go back and watch them first before watching this part three, because the course is organized in such a way that each part sort of rests on the previous ones. It assumes that you have seen and watched the previous ones. All right, so let's go for it. Part three will be similar to part two, but instead of critiquing mainstream physicalism, we are going to critique constitutive panpsychism, which is the new fashionable metaphysical hypothesis in the world of analytic philosophy today, and one even espoused by mainstream well-known neuroscientists like Christoph Koch, Giulio Tononi, arguably Sam Harris entertains this, although I don't know much about Sam. I just heard that he entertains this hypothesis. I've debated his wife once, and she clearly is pro-panpsychism. So let's dive into this. What is constitutive panpsychism? Well, let me first acknowledge that under the name panpsychism, there are a number of widely different hypotheses put forward. Some versions of panpsychism are very, very close to analytic idealism, which we are going to talk about in the next part. But the one I will be discussing today is the one that is normally called constitutive panpsychism, which is a specific formulation of panpsychism, and it is the most fashionable one. It is the formulation that most people understand to be meant by the word panpsychism, if you don't qualify it. Now, what is it then? The idea is the following. Panpsychists acknowledge that the hard problem of consciousness is not really a problem. It's an internal contradiction of physicalism, and therefore we need an alternative to physicalism. So in that specific sense, panpsychism is a step forward insofar as it lets us see that there is an acknowledgement in large parts, respected parts of academia, that physicalism is not bringing us anywhere. It is simply a contradictory, inadequate hypothesis. Having said that, I don't think panpsychism is any better than physicalism. It tries to address one problem without really solving it, and it runs into other problems that physicalism doesn't have. Constitutive panpsychism is the idea that consciousness is not emergent. It is not a epiphenomenon. It's not something that unconscious matter somehow magically creates. It is something fundamental in matter. So matter at its elementary level, so elementary subatomic particles like electrons, quarks, and so on, next to having physical properties like electric charge, spin, mass, these elementary subatomic particles also have fundamental phenomenal properties. In other words, qualitative experience. So constitutive panpsychism says that experience is just one more of the fundamental properties of matter, and therefore inherent in all elementary subatomic particles of a given type, if not in all elementary subatomic particles, period. So an electron has its own little micro-consciousness. It is a little micro-subject with a conscious inner life of its own. And that conscious inner life is not reducible. You cannot explain it in terms of anything else. It is just a fundamental property of the electron. It's a given of nature, according to constitutive panpsychists. I will from now on just use the word panpsychism and panpsychists instead of qualifying it with constitutive, but I will be meaning every single time constitutive panpsychism unless I explicitly say otherwise. So you could summarize panpsychism as the statement that all matter is conscious. Now, does it avoid the hard problem? Yes, in that it does not require an explanation for consciousness. It does not require reducing consciousness to something else that is not consciousness. And that's the heart of the hard problem. But is this a valid way of circumventing the hard problem? I would say it isn't, because it's not really explaining anything, it's just adding one more thing to our reduction base. Now, a reduction base in philosophy are those fundamental building blocks of nature in terms of which we can explain everything else, but which themselves have no explanation. We just say, well, nature is like this, period. And that is unavoidable, because you cannot have a theory of nature that keeps forever on explaining one thing in terms of something else. At some point, you either go circular or you hit rock bottom. And then this final thing, which itself has no explanation, but in terms of which you can explain lots of other things, that is called an element in our reduction base. Reduction in philosophy is a technical word for explanation. So to reduce something is to explain it in terms of something else. And the reduction base contains those something else's in terms of which you explain the rest of nature. Now, a good theory of nature is one that has very few elements in your reduction base. That's the one that has the most explanatory power. You explain everything in terms of very few things. And the best theories of nature are those that have only one thing in the reduction base, only one irreducible fundamental element of nature, in terms of which you can explain everything else. So what does panpsychism do? It simply adds another element to the reduction base, namely consciousness, mind. It doesn't explain mind, it just labels it as something that we don't need to explain. I think this is more of a cop-out than an explanation. I don't think this is a satisfying way out of the hard problem of consciousness. But anyway, this is what panpsychists do. And then after having postulated that elementary subatomic particles are microsubjects, they then postulate that these microsubjects combine with one another in some way that is not clearly specified to form the macro subject that we are. We have seemingly a unitary inner life. I don't experience myself as gazillions of little subjects talking to each other. I experience myself as one subject with one integrated mind. So if my mind is formed somehow out of the little micro-consciousnesses of the elementary subatomic particles inside my head, then these micro-consciousnesses or this micro-subject somehow have to combine to form my consciousness, my unitary macro-mind. And that's exactly what panpsychists postulate, but in a more or less hand-waving way. They don't say how that combination actually happens, and they don't produce an undeniable empirical evidence that such combination actually happens in nature. Because, you know, even if you can't explain something explicitly and conceptually all the way, if you can say, well, although I can't really make total sense of it, look, it happens in nature. If you can do that, then that's better than an explanation. Because the explanation is supposed to highlight the plausibility that something actually happens. But if you can show it happening, that's stronger than the explanation. But yeah, panpsychists cannot point out a concrete, unambiguous example in nature in which combination happens. They might say, well, but the fact that we are conscious subjects at a macro level proves that combination happens. Well, that begs the question, of course. There is only evidence for a combination if you, to begin, assume that combination happens. So what I mean by empirical evidence is not one that begs the question, is not one that assumes your hypothesis in the interpretation of the evidence, but one that is objective and unambiguous. And you say, look, this is actually happening. There is no other way to make sense of these empirical facts other than combination. So according to panpsychists, we are sort of emergent subjects. Our consciousness is not fundamental. We are actually made up of gazillions of little micro consciousnesses, each one attached to one of the elementary particles that make up our brain. So in a sense, and that's why I put this picture here, this is erosion on a rock that looks like a face with a nose, with two eyes here, my big screaming mouth. And what I'm trying to sort of evoke in you is this notion that panpsychism is related to, you know, old-fashioned animism, the idea that inanimate objects are conscious in some way. And if you consider an elementary subatomic particle an inanimate object, then panpsychism relates to animism in some ways, not all the way, but in some sense. All right, so let's start looking at the problems. I already mentioned one, which is, well, panpsychism doesn't really explain anything. It just throws something else into the reduction base in an attempt to avoid an explanation altogether. So I find this not satisfying at all. But independent and next to that, there are three other major problems. One of them is, and I alluded to already, there is no explicit, coherent way to make sense of this notion that microsubjects somehow can combine in such a way that their micro fields of experience combine into a higher level, emergent, but unitary field of combined experience. The force of constitutive panpsychism is in trying to account for the formation of our consciousness in terms of micro-consciousnesses, in the same way that chemistry, for instance, accounts for the properties of substances or molecules in terms of its constitutive elements, like atoms. But this doesn't work for panpsychism. There has been a paper in 2014, which I will list below in the description of this video, which shows that this is incoherent. For instance, if you have two electrons in your brain, and one of them fundamentally sees red or experiences redness, and the other one fundamentally experiences blueness, the idea of panpsychism would be that if they combine, then the combination experiences purpleness, a combination of blue and red. But this isn't coherent. You can't compare that to chemistry, because when two atoms combine to form a molecule, yes, new properties emerge, but the atoms themselves, other than sharing some electrons on the outer orbitals, they remain what they are. The atoms are there, present in the molecule. But if we say that an electron that sees redness and another electron that experiences blueness combine, and then the result experiences purpleness, then where is the redness? Where is the blueness? They sort of disappear. They are subsumed into this purpleness, and there is no explicit and coherent mechanism to account for that. So not only is it not comparable to how chemical properties emerge through chemical combinations, like covalent combinations, so not only is this analogy not legitimate, there is no coherent account for how this stuff happens. You see, we might be tempted to say that if you're a panpsychist, that the consciousnesses of different electrons combine, if the electrons sort of go into the same orbital, if they combine in some way, if they're physically close or touch in a colloquial way, or a colloquial sense of touch. The problem is, even at a fairly high level, almost microscopic level, neurons don't touch each other. I don't mean by this that there is a vacuum between neurons. Of course not. Somebody once criticized me by saying, oh, there is actually something in between the neurons. That's not what I mean. What I mean is the parts that you identify as one neuron and the parts you identify as another neuron, they don't touch each other. There is something else in between them, which we call a synaptic cleft. And that's what I illustrate here. So this is the synapse or the extreme of one neuron. And this is the neuron body of another neuron. So this is the tip of a dendrite of one neuron, and this is the body of another neuron. The synaptic cleft is this space here in between. And neurons communicate by releasing neurotransmitters, which are originally encapsulated in this little sacs inside the neuron. These sacs come to the edge, and then they open up. And these neurotransmitters are then released in the synaptic cleft, and they physically drift towards these receptors here on the other neuron. So when they attach into the receptors, then if enough of this happens, then there is an electrochemical charge communicated between the neurons. So neurons don't even touch. So how are we to account for this notion that the combined consciousness of one neuron combines at a yet higher level with the consciousness of another neuron, if they aren't even touching, if there is just some molecules drifting between the space in the space between them? And if these were possible, then why doesn't my consciousness combine with my girlfriend's consciousness if we touch each other, if we make love? I mean, we would then be very close, but our consciousnesses don't seem to combine. So this is one of the problems in panpsychism. There are technical papers, which I will list below again, which argue that this problem is as insoluble, it's called the combination problem, it's as insoluble as the heart problem itself. I wouldn't go quite that far. I think that it's comparable. I think the heart problem is really in your face, the incoherence of that. It shows the incoherence of physicalism. This one is not that bad, but it is not a problem that can be solved. Now, the second problem of panpsychism is a problem of simple logic, simple reasoning. I think the reasoning behind panpsychism is equivocated. It's wrong. And let me be explicit about where it goes wrong. And it's in the first statement of this slide here. That's where it goes wrong. It assumes or it attributes to the perceiver, the subject of perception, a structure that is discernible only in that which is perceived, in the object of perception. And there is no reason for you to import the structure of what is the structure of what's perceived to the subject of perception itself. That there is simply no logical requirement for you to make that move. So let me explain to you why this is so, where they are doing this. The world we perceive can be divided down into ever smaller building blocks until we get to fundamental subatomic particles. Arguably, we can go further down to fields. I will talk about it soon. But let's stop here for now. You can divide the world that we see on the screen of perception, on the dashboard of dials, down to elementary subatomic particles. That is then the structure of the perceived world. And then the panpsychist reasons that since we are part of the world, and since when we look at ourselves or at other people, we also know that we can divide the body of a person down to elementary subatomic particles, then the panpsychist says, therefore the subject must also be dividable down to micro subjectivities, micro consciousnesses, which are equivalent or which are mapped one-to-one to the elementary subatomic particles. Well, no, that is wrong. Let me give you an example. Suppose you are seeing a person on your computer screen. Now, computer screens today have such a high resolution that you don't see the pixels. But if you were to zoom in into the face of a person as it's displayed on your computer screen, you would see that it's pixelated. It's made up of little rectangles or squares, each with a different color. And you don't see them if you look from a distance, because then you don't have enough visual resolution to discern the pixels. But the image of a person on your computer screen is made up of little blocks that we call pixels. Does that mean that the person herself is made of little squares? Of course not! The pixelation is an artifact of the representation of the person. It's an artifact of how the person is perceived by you. It is not the structure of the person. The person's body is not made of little squares. It's not made of pixels. And that's the error the panpsychist makes. It attributes the pixelation of the screen of perception, the pixelation of the dashboard of dials, to the perceiver, to the subject of perception. Now, this is as arbitrary, and arbitrary also in exactly the same way, as it is arbitrary to say that you are made of little squares, simply because that's how you are represented to me when I see you through my screen, in a Zoom call or on a Skype call, whatever. It is exactly the same error. It's this arbitrary carrying over of the structure of one thing to the structure of another, for which there is absolutely no logical reason. So the very logical motivation for panpsychism, the notion that because our bodies as displayed on the screen of perception, because that's what the body is. A body is a representation on the dashboard of dials that we talked about in part one. A body is something that is perceived. There is no reason to think that because the body is subjected to the resolution of your dashboard of dials and therefore gets pixelated when represented there, there is no reason to think that that which is represented, that the real reality that is represented by the body on the dashboard of dials, that that real reality is also pixelated. And that real reality, of course, is our conscious inner life. So there is no reason to think that our conscious inner life is also made up of a combination of gazillions of little subjectivities, simply because our bodies are pixelated when displayed on the screen of perception, on the dashboard. In other words, simply because our bodies are made of elementary subatomic particles. So I've repeated this several times now in the hope that repetition helps drive the message. I will repeat it one final time. The fact that our bodies are made up of elementary subatomic particles tells us simply of the resolution limits of our dashboard of dials, of the screen of perception. The elementary subatomic particles that make up our body are the pixels of our internal dashboard, of the screen of perception. It's an artifact of the screen that represents the world, not an artifact of the world as it is in and of itself. In other words, it is not the structure of the subject that gets represented on the dashboard of dials as a body, as a biological, living, metabolizing body. Making this error is entirely equivalent to saying that a person is made up of little squares just because that's how the person is represented on the screen. All right, that was the second problem. The third problem, and you know, I think any one of the previous problems alone is already reason enough for us to completely discard constitutive panpsychism as a completely unhelpful hypothesis, positive only in the way that it reflects an acceptance of the hard problem, not only as a problem, but as a sort of internal logical inconsistency in physicalism. But having said that, the third problem is even worse for panpsychism, because it shows that constitutive panpsychism is physically incoherent. It embodies a fundamental misunderstanding of what we know from foundations of physics since at least the 1950s. And the problem is the following. The way panpsychism explains why my mind seems to be separate from yours, after all, I can't read your thoughts or see the world from your perspective, and presumably neither can you see the world from my perspective or read my thoughts. So our minds are separated. And the way panpsychism accounts for it is to say that the elementary subjectivities, the gazillions of little subjects that constitute my brain, they combine only inside my brain because they are spatially close to each other, so to say. So they can physically combine. But they don't combine with the subjectivities that form your brain, because my brain is spatially separate from yours. So it is this ability to distinguish things in space, to have spatial distance between two brains that allows panpsychists to tentatively account for the fact that I can't read your thoughts or see the world from your perspective, and neither the other way around, because our brains are physically separate. Right. But that is based on the assumption that elementary subatomic particles are like little bodies, corpuscles, with well-delineated spatial boundaries, which is the way colloquially most non-specialists visualize elementary subatomic particles, because the name particles seems to evoke in our visualization the idea of a little grain of sand or a little ball, something small but with defined spatial boundaries. So that assumption is fundamental to panpsychism, because if elementary subatomic particles do not have these well-defined discrete spatial boundaries, then panpsychism cannot explain why my mind is separate from yours. Right. Is this then so, that elementary subatomic particles are indeed these little bodies with defined discrete spatial boundaries? No, that's not what we know from physics. That we visualize the elementary subatomic particles that way is just a metaphor. It helps us think about it. In reality, we know that what's going on is that for each type of elementary subatomic particle, and there are 17 types last time I looked at the standard model, for each type of elementary subatomic particles, there corresponds a field, a quantum field, which has no spatial boundaries. So all these 17 quantum fields span the entire universe without spatial boundaries. And what we call particles are just patterns of excitation on this field. Now let me explain this with a metaphor. Suppose you have a lake with a very calm surface, not disturbed at all, like a mirror surface on the lake. And then there comes the wind, or you throw a pebble in the lake and you create ripples, like here. You create a ripple here, there's another ripple there. So you create several ripples. Now, these ripples have well-identified physical properties. You can point at where they are. You can say, here is the peak of a ripple. That's where the ripple is. A moment later, the ripple will be a little bit further away, and you can still point at it, and you say, there is the ripple. The ripple will have a certain height, will have a certain direction of movement, will have a certain speed of movement, will have a certain width. There are lots of physical properties that you can attach accurately to the ripple. And again, you can point at the ripple and say, there is the ripple. There the ripple begins, there the ripple ends. Its flow, it's going this direction with that speed, with that height. These are all physical properties that can be described with numbers. A number for speed, say centimeters per second. Another number for height, say inches, and so on and so forth. Now, the same goes for a subatomic particle. We can attribute physical properties to a subatomic particle, like spin, like momentum, electric charge, mass. Just like we can attribute physical properties to the ripple, like speed, direction of movement, height, width, and so on. However, notice that there is nothing to the ripple but the lake in which it ripples. You cannot lift the ripple out of the lake, because the ripple is the lake in movement. What we call a ripple is simply a doing of the lake. It is not a thing. It's not a noun. It's a verb. What we call a ripple is just shorthand for describing what the lake is doing, the way the water in the lake is moving, is being excited. by the pebble you threw in or the wind. There is nothing to the ripple but the lake. Now, in exactly the same way, according to quantum field theory or QFT, there is nothing to the elementary subatomic particle, like an electron, but the quantum field in which that electron ripples. Actually, the ripple of the quantum field is the electron. The excitation of quantum field is what we call the electron. And that excitation has physical properties, mass, charge, momentum, and so on, just like the ripple has physical properties, speed, direction of movement, height, width, and so forth. Yet there is nothing to the electron but the quantum field. To talk of the electron as a thing, as a noun, is just a metaphor. It's analogous to the way we talk of a ripple as a thing, as a noun. But the ripple is a doing. It's a verb. It's the lake doing something. You can't remove the ripple from the lake. In the same way, you can't remove the electron from the quantum field of the electron. There is no electron. There is only the quantum field. What we call an electron is just a pattern of excitation of the quantum field. And now, the important point. The quantum field has no spatial boundaries. Therefore, if the panpsychist wants to attribute consciousness as a fundamental property to an equally fundamental physical entity, then the panpsychist has to attribute that consciousness to the quantum field, because the quantum field is all that exists. The lake is all that exists. The panpsychist cannot attribute consciousness to the electron, because the electron is just a metaphor for a pattern of excitation of the field. The only thing that exists is the field. But if the panpsychist does that, then there would be 17 universal consciousnesses, one for each field, and the panpsychist would fail to account for the fact that I can't read your thoughts, because these fields have no spatial boundaries. So the electrons in my brain are just patterns of excitation of the same field that permeates your brain. All 17 quantum fields will connect my brain to yours, because they span the entire universe. They span through our bodies. So the panpsychist cannot account for individual consciousness if panpsychism is to be made coherent from a physical point of view. The whole idea of panpsychism is based on a fairly naive physical misunderstanding. Now, I've made this argument before, and the only vaguely tenable reply I've gotten, and that was from Philip Goff, was the point that there is an alternative formulation, an alternative theory in physics called the de Broglie-Bohm theory, which sort of contradicts quantum field theory. It doesn't postulate this spatially unbound field. It postulates global properties, but the particles under the Broglie-Bohm interpretation are still elementary little things with spatial boundaries. The problem with that is that there are gazillions of reasons why the Broglie-Bohm interpretation is not tenable. Actually, de Broglie himself abandoned his own interpretation. He said, well, that doesn't work. Before he died, he abandoned his own approach, which David Bohm then insisted on in the 50s. But the originator of the theory gave it up. There are many reasons for that. It escapes the scope of this course to go into details. I will link some literature in the description of this video, so you can study it further yourself. But the main reason would be that the de Broglie-Bohm theory has no relativistic extension. In other words, it's impossible to reconcile it with the general relativity, because any attempt to reconcile quantum theory with relativity implies this notion of spatially unbound fields. So in my view, and in the view of a great many scientists who have looked into this, a great many physicists, that theory is untenable. In other words, there is no way to save panpsychism. If it is to be made consistent with physics, In other words, if it is to be made physically coherent, it fails to explain individual consciousness, and therefore it fails to explain what it was meant to explain to begin with. I think this is a killer for panpsychism. Any one of the previews already is a killer, but this is really definitive, I think. Okay, so where does this leave us? You know, we've looked at mainstream physicalism, we've looked at constitutive panpsychism, and neither seems to fit the bill, neither seems to be tenable or to explain what they are meant to explain. Now, we need an alternative, and that alternative, as we will see in the next part, entails some form of spatially unbound field of subjectivity, a universal mind, if you will. But it's important to highlight that whatever alternative we come up with, as we will do next time, we must acknowledge that there is a world beyond our personal, individual minds. There is a world we share. Even if that world is mental, it is not in my mind alone and it's not in your mind alone. There is something out there that is not in our personal minds. This must be acknowledged. We have no reason, stating the obvious here, but we have no reason to believe that individual inanimate objects like a rock or a telephone or a computer or these spectacles, we have no reason to think that they have a private conscience in their life of their own. Nothing indicates that. But we might have very good reasons to say that they are in consciousness. And this is a big difference. To say that everything is conscious is one thing, that's panpsychism. To say that everything is in consciousness is an entirely different thing. And that's what we are going to explore in part four. We are going to look at the thing that gives a name to this course, analytic idealism, a modern analytic formulation of the ontology of idealism, which postulates that underlying all nature, there is a spatially extended form of subjectivity, of mind, a universal mind, if you will. And then, of course, then the idealist has to face the challenge of explaining how individual minds arise within that universal mind, such that it's accounted the fact is accounted for that I can't read your thoughts and neither can you read mine. So we are going to explore this in the next part, this hypothesis that I consider to be not only a superior hypothesis, but frankly, the only game in town today. And I don't say this out of arrogance. I say this objectively, having looked at these issues for well over a decade now. I don't see any other way to get out of our dilemma. We will see that in the next part. Again, I recommend you don't jump straight to it. Give it a day or two. Think about what you've heard today. Think about panpsychism, what it means, what its implications are, and why it doesn't hold water, why it's not tenable, why it's not even plausible. And only then jump into part four. Now, part four will be long. It will be quite a journey. We will cover a lot of material in part four. So try to be rested and to reserve enough time to go through it. 1 hour, 1.5 hours at least. And then we will face that challenge together. Till then, take care and I'll see you soon.